From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
We've all heard the environmentally conscious advice, the way we used to clean up our gardens extra tidy, but to within an inch of its life for every unseen beneficial creature out there trying to tuck in for winter is not the best practice. I'm learning and evolving my approach as I go the last few years, reading up about guidance like leave the leaves and cutback strategies like chop and drop and more, and asking experts for help, including today's guest, Uli Lorimer, Director of Horticulture at Native Plant Trust. So more in a moment, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top-quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
Uli Lorimer, author of The Northeast Native Plant Primer, has made native plants his career. In 2019, he became Director of Horticulture at Native Plant Trust, America's oldest plant conservation organization. And before that, he was longtime curator of the Native Flora Garden at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. Hi, Uli, and welcome back. Thank you. Coming just in time for fall cleanup. You're going to help me, right?
Yes. Thank you for having me on again. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
So you brought a rake?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I need an umbrella today, but yes.
Oh, you're having, okay. By the way, I saw your byline in another place, or byline in quotes, in another place too, not so long ago, not just on the book, which we'll have a giveaway with the transcript over on Away to Garden. We'll have a giveaway of the Northeast Native Plant Primer. But I also saw on these native plant folding guides from the publisher Earth, Sky, and Water, these sort of laminated multiple panel guides that you can like fold up and take with you to ID plants and insects and all kinds of things. I saw that you did some of those. Was that fun?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a fun project that kind of got squeezed in the beginning of the early days of the pandemic. And surprisingly that there wasn't a wildflower guide for the Northeast, lots of bird guides and insect guides and butterfly guides and so forth. But it was fun. It was challenging because you have very little space to write a description, and
yes,
you want to write something that isn't immediately apparent with the illustration. So that I found that was kind of a nice challenge, and I'm really happy with the way that the guide turned out.
Yeah. Well, I'll show with the transcript. I can show the link to people can look at those. They're wonderful. So I have them, and they're wonderful. A cheat sheet, kind of.
Yes.
And weatherproof.
Yes, indeed.
So the first serious round of leaves dropped big time here where I am this week in Zone 5B. And there's lots more to come, but it's, quote, cleanup time. And, you know, you've worked at public gardens through your career, and I suspect that there's a tension between sort of aesthetic and our increasingly ecological understanding, even if it's, well, especially if it's not at a place like Native Plant Trust and its properties, that's, you know, heavily ecological, but you probably understand that tension. You know, you want to look great for the public, but you want to do the right thing for nature. So let's just sort of talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was really apparent during my time at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, because nearly every inch of the 52 acres there is cultivated, and there are extensive lawn surfaces, and kind of an expectation that the lawns look clean, almost like a green carpet, to kind of contrast what's happening in the beds. And the approach there was either to shred them in place, or we had these little vacuum attachments to the riding mowers where we could, suck them up. They'd get shredded a little bit. And then for the gardeners that were interested in shredded leaves, the grounds crew would come around and dump a load wherever you wanted of these nice shredded leaves that you could then put back onto the bed. So we did really try to keep all of that resource on site. So whether they were shredded or whether they became sort of a leaf mold pile that might get used later on in making compost or in potting soils, that was the approach. And I think that, fortunately at Native Plant Trust and the Garden of the Woods, we really don't have much in the way of lawn surfaces, so it's not that big of an issue for us. But I recognize that many people do have lawns, and I don't see really any issues with cleaning up the lawns as they were. What I think the bigger issue becomes is when people feel compelled to clean out the leaves from the garden beds. I was just having a conversation recently with somebody who for years and years would rake out the beds, shred the leaves, and then put them back on the beds. And I asked her, I said, that's a lot of work. Like, you know, you set yourself up for a lot of work to put down things that, you know, are just fine if you let them stay where they fall. And that really kind of gets at the balance that people have to strike between aesthetics and you know, what we're understanding as ecological function for that layer of leaf litter.
Right. So, I mean, Doug Tallamy of University of Delaware, you know, who's written so much about to increase our awareness of the ecological importance of practices and plantings and so forth, he calls this tactic of, you know, doing enough so that someone knows it's a quote garden, you know, is he calls it a cue for care. So, and Rebecca McMacken, who I know is a friend of yours, a colleague of yours, she who was at Brooklyn Bridge Park for many years, she, you know, also would talk about how in that public space, they'd kind of maintain like the edges and, you know, keep the edges looking tidy, obviously the paths and things like that. Do you know what I mean? So that you could say, hey, again, like Doug says, cue for care, a hint, but without destroying the ecological value.
Yeah. And I think that's a really wonderful nuanced approach, because it doesn't take that much to create kind of distinctions between, you know, a path surface or, you know, the leading edge of a bed, and allowing for, you know, that what all of the experts talk about, that, you know, the messy is actually what nature wants.
Right.
And kind of leaving that, you know, a little bit further back in the bed.
Right.
And it shows, because the other thing, which is, you know, I would say perhaps a bigger topic, but, you know, folks are very quick to deem spaces untidy, or even overgrown. And I actually sort of one of my like personal pet peeves about overgrown, because it comes from a place of saying that there isn't that cue for care if you can't immediately see it. And then it gets used as justification to come in and clear or tidy. Why not look at a space like that and say it's bursting with life? Look at what this particular patch is capable of sustaining, even if we don't find it immediately aesthetically pleasing. Doesn't mean that it needs to be, you know, reined in or cut back, or, you know, any other things that we do to gardens.
Right. So we're not only evolving our cleanup regimen, our protocol, our tactics, but we have to also start to adjust our vision a little bit so that we see a little bit differently about what is cared for and looks good and so forth. And so you were just talking about like lawns, and I mean, you can't just leave, especially like oak leaves, you know, a whole sheet of oak leaves across the lawn areas. And hopefully we're reducing our lawns, so this is less of an issue for us, because we're planting more diverse things in place of the miles of lawn. And you talked about, you know, further back in the bed, leaving things. And so, you know, I have like it began as almost like a collector's garden and of many non-native plants included in it, you know, 30 plus years ago. And now there's a lot more large scale native plantings and so forth. But in the areas that are like, you know, where I have tiny bulbs that come up early in the spring and, you know, aranthus or snowdrops or whatever, you know, I'm not going to leave 3 inches thick of leaves on top of those. I'm going to tease that off because I know those babies want to come through, you know, come through early, and a big, heavy, wet mess, they're not going to be able to. But at the perimeter of my property and under big native trees, especially the oaks, I'm really making almost like safety zones where I'm not cleaning up. Do you know what I mean? Where I'm doing more of what you said. Is that kind of what you're saying to us that we should do, is to like map out areas where we can be, let it all hang out?
Yeah. I mean, you know, let's consider this perspective that, you know, if you observe plants that can grow strongly, so things that are able to push through that, you know, thicker strata of leaves, then those are good places. You know, if you notice an area where, The wind blows them in. Maybe it's a little depression or something
Yes.
where they naturally accumulate. Then that's the place to try to design for that condition.
Oh, that's such a great idea. That's
And
such a
then,
great idea.
and then, so thinking another. So the converse of that is then, if there are places that are naturally thin and sort of windswept, if you would like, maybe where there's a moss patch or something. Those are places where you can start working with some of those more delicate, smaller, diminutive plants, the kinds that, as you indicated, would be smothered if it were under too much leaf litter.
Right.
And and to that effect too, I think that for folks that either hire services or use services or use equipment like blowers, to also think about where you blow the leaves year in and year out.
Yes.
Because that's another thing that we're, at Garden in the Woods, we have this one section of the garden. It's kind of a it's a transitional space that we call Laurel Bend, and it had traditionally had many, much more mountain laurel, but they were in decline. And so we started kind of investigating a little bit, and it turns out that some of the stems were buried in, nearly 12 inches of leaf litter. And it was apparent because every year when you blew off the paths to make the paths tidy, you were kept blowing it into and into the, the stems would catch the leaves, and then they would sit. And then the next year you would do it again and again. And so, they were accumulating at a rate faster than what nature would have done,
And they were
and to
like
the detriment of those
suffocating.
plants.
And the natural duff layer that would have come from the maybe deciduous trees adjacent or above that would have been much lighter duff layer than this
Yes.
man-made debris. So just because, pushing
We're
debris out of the
shifting it
way.
from one place to another. And so, and the way that we approach our operations and management of the space is we're trying to be more conscious of those kinds of situations where we, traditionally would have put the leaves in the same place every year. Maybe that's a spot where we rake it into a pile and pick it up and move it to, a mulch pile or something. And then there are other areas where, you can disperse the leaves with a blower without any concern.
I mean, I don't think there's any one size fits all guidance here for every landscape. It's these types of insights that you're saying, like looking for spaces where the leaves naturally accumulate and thinking about maybe letting that be a wilder, messier place and so forth and so forth.
Designing your garden to include plants that don't mind coming through a thicker leaf layer. And to say that, we have fairly extensive areas with woodland phlox and creeping phlox. And so it's, in the winter it's a, almost like a basal rosette, a ground cover. And so we found that, it actually likes a little bit of leaf protection, sort of like insulation over the winter, but then it's something that will tease off most of it in the springtime so that it won't have to struggle through the thicker layers. So that's another approach.
Talking about then the other aspect besides leave the leaves, as I mentioned, I think in the introduction, is like that sort of chop and drop, the perennial cutbacks and doing that a little differently where we do need to do it or want to do it. And it used to be you cut everything down and that was it. And sometimes you put on a little fresh mulch or whatever, but it was like it was just to within an inch of its life. And now we know that standing material is tons of bird food and overwintering sites similar to the leaf litter. It has all this ecological advantage. And so what, how, are there places where you do cutbacks? Are there places when, and kind of, do you do them in stages and phases or,
I mean, I would add that I think there's also a growing awareness of the aesthetic benefits of leaving up seed heads, and so that there's more three-dimensional structure rather than this idea of, a fresh start in the spring where everything comes out of the ground at the same time. We have a sort of small grassland that we manage in that way, in which, some plants get cut back, others that we think have stout stems and seed heads that are attractive will leave in place. We tend to cut things to a maximum of 18 inches, but nothing less than that, because those stems, even if and this was something that was kind of an aha moment for me recently, that not every perennial stem is hollow, at least when it's actively growing. Some have a hollow cavity. Many have a pith. So the insects that nest in those, they don't actually nest in like this year's.
Right. Stem. They nest still in, tender. Right. Right.
Yeah. It takes time for that cavity to develop. And so that's why it's important to leave those things upstanding, or even, as you said, cut and bundled or cut and dropped nearby, to allow for those cavities to develop. And that is what the insects are after the following year and the year after that. And so that's something I think is also important, that, having those stems, you can bundle them if it's more aesthetically pleasing, or you can leave them where they lay. And next year's foliage kind of grows through all of it, and it gets hidden in a hurry. By May, you never know what's under there, but the insects do, which is the important part.
Right. And so if you're leaving things up 18 inches or whatever, so like meadow management, or you said a grassland, you know, areas that are lots of perennials in close proximity. Again, speaking to sort of Doug Tallamy's kind of advice and so forth, he would say, well, if you can cut back a third of it every year, not all of it one year, because to your point, then you've always got some standing stems that are 18 inches or more, that are going to ripen or harden and become those places of refuge for stem nesting bees and so forth. You've got different ages of material. So that's another, is it to shift to do it on a partial, is either to cut it back partway or to every year cut a chunk of it back, I think is another way to go about it.
No, I mean, it's sound advice. I think you can also, from year to year, leave different clumps of things standing, so it's not always the same thing. And that helps to kind of spread out that resource as Dr. Tallamy suggests.
Yeah. Yeah. So this sort of chop and drop that we're talking about. So if we do reduce the height of something, we're leaving the trimmings in smallish pieces beside the parent plant, kind of. So like seeds are getting to the ground and they're still there for someone to eat, and there's debris for them to tuck into and so forth. So it's not carting it away on a tarp, right, to the compost heap. Is that your approach there? I mean,
portions of it. Again, I feel like, as we talked about earlier, there is this sort of friction between aesthetic and how people how they conceive of that in their gardens, and the desire to maximize ecological function. And I think that that threshold of how much of this can I tolerate is going to be different for some people, and we're hoping that people will increasingly be more tolerant of let's say like half of the debris staying and maybe the other half gets carted away, or three quarters of it. But in the end becomes, as so many things in gardens, a personal choice.
Yeah. I mean, I'm finding, and my place is a couple of acres, so it's different from a lot of smaller places. But then again, you're talking about how many acres are you there at Garden of the Woods?
45.
Yeah. So that's a whole different scale. What I'm finding is, because I'm an old gardener, I learned the old traditional ways. So what I'm finding that for me is the easier evolution is I'm identifying, as I spoke about briefly earlier, areas that can be this more native heavy and also a little wilder, looser. I'm transitioning some areas to that kind of planting and management. And that is in a way making it easier than in areas where, say, closer to the house in a more formal bed where I've got a mix of native and non-native plants, it's harder for me to come up with a strategy for those. Do you know what I mean? Because again, there might be a little flower bulb planting underneath, or there might be, tiny primulas that are going to come, or, Yeah, so I'm finding by devoting areas in the periphery of the property coming in from the property line, which is I used to mow up to the property line on two sides, and I've backed up and I've come in and unmown those areas, and those have become my target areas for, all these beautiful oak leaves that fall on the lawn. They're moving over to the, you know what I'm saying? Is like, can we create zones, even small zones, that we can manage a little looser?
Well, and those more delicate plantings are a perfect place to take, shredded leaves that fall on your site and
Yes.
to mulch them and to enjoy that, a little bit tidier aesthetic. If you have the space to allow the edges to be a little bit rougher or more wild. I wanted to ask, how do you manage your woody debris?
Ha. Yeah. It's a problem. I'm surrounded by woods, and so I have a deer fence around most of the place, and there is some opportunity right outside the fence at the perimeter of my property to have some brush piles and so forth. So I do that with large woody things. Like if I lose a tree, I let the carcass lie unless it was right in the middle of the backyard by the door or something. I mean, I'm and people kind of look agog, when they see that, because I've got some carcasses here. Some old friends who are lying on the ground now, degrading into the soil and becoming part
Giving
of
it
the
up.
life. And, that's my thing. So I try to make brush piles that aren't in prime area where I'm looking at them every day, because the nature of the garden right around the house doesn't allow for that visually to my eye. And I'm putting them at the perimeter, but I do have a couple. And large, went takedowns, which I try never to take something down and make it a snag for years. And then eventually, if it has to come down or it comes down itself, I try to leave the carcass lie. And that's, that's a different aesthetic, and not everyone would like that. But to me, it's important biomass that I want to have in stay in the community,
Well, I bring it up because it reminds me of sort of two different approaches that I have. Well, one is the idea of using that woody brushy debris a little bit more intentionally to, kind of you can make almost like a fence line with it. If you sink in a couple of vertical posts, then you can kind of weave it in between, or orient everything in the same direction so that it looks a little more visually pleasing. But those brush piles are also really critical habitat for mammals and small birds and other things and insects that I think also need to figure into. Anybody who manages a garden knows you're inevitably going to have twigs and sticks and other things to deal with. And they can be treated kind of similarly with that same kind of intention to benefit wildlife. The other approach I wanted to bring up is one that I have had long conversations with one of my former colleagues, Chris Roddick, which I think you probably
Sure.
is.
Also formerly at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, yes,
Yes.
an arborist.
And it's about looking at how to prune trees to create sort of micro habitats for fungi and for other sorts of things, and that there's this a movement within the larger arboriculture community to don't just do flush cuts. If there's a natural break, then leave that because that has all these little nooks and crannies that are places for insects and for lichens and fungi and other things to come into place, and even mimicking a natural breaks through what are called coronet cuts. So you're kind of using the chainsaw to rough it up and make it look jagged and natural.
That's what I do with my snags. Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah. I can give some links to that as well, to some of his work.
there's lots of wonderful information about how to do that and so forth. And it, you know, I for me and my as my aesthetic has developed over the years, I would prefer to look at a snag. Or what looked like a broken branch than a flush cut,
Yeah,
and
no,
it
I know what you mean. It looks artificial.
well, and it also it means that humans have been there,
Yes,
and
exact evidence of human, yes. In the last like minute or So I just want to ask you, I know you have a virtual event that I want to alert people to coming up in November, The Need for Seed, a symposium. Yes. About the need for in restoration to have a good supply of seed or regional seed sources. Yes. Of natives. But just to say that there's lots of education, much of it virtual, available through Native Plant Trust, right? And I'd love to give the link with the transcript of that. But there's some great events coming up. Yes.
Yeah. The symposium is we're really excited to launch this. The registration is free for all the participants, thanks to support from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
That's great.
And really what we're doing is we're, as an organization, trying to step in to, fill a really missing piece in the native plant material supply chain in the Northeast. And that is
so important. Yeah.
There aren't enough facilities to clean and store seed. And there's a huge gap in the availability of genetically diverse, regionally appropriate, locally collected seed that, not only feeds into restoration projects, but would also feed into like retail consumer demand and growing plants from those seeds.
Well, I'll give the link to that and lots of other links with this, the transcript of the show. I'm so glad to talk about cleanup and more. Now you're going to get me going out and looking at my brush piles. So good. Thank you, Uli. Thanks for making time this morning.
You bet.
Talk to you soon again, I hope.
Thank you, Margaret.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening and cleaning up meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.